Okay, I'm an alcoholic. My name is Tom.
Hey, Tom.
And I want to just first say, can everybody hear me all right? You guys okay? All right. So I just want to say that I'm just truly blessed and I'm humbled to be here tonight. And it's really an honor for me to be here and to sit here and get to be here. So I think it's important that you just know a couple of things about this person that's sitting in front of you. And I think the first thing that you should know is that I was separated from alcohol on March 13th, 2007. I have a sponsor. His name is Carl B. And he has a sponsor, and his name is Father Jack. My home group that I still call my home group is the Dawn Patrol. We meet 6:30 a.m. Monday through Saturday, and everyone says it, so I'm going to say it. We don't get many mistakes that come rolling in at 6:30 a.m. in the morning, trying to figure out whether or not they belong there. But that group is truly a blessing in my life. They are all about the steps. They are about sponsorship. They are about a higher power, and mine I choose to call God. So, before I get into this part of it, I want you to just know that a little bit about my family. And I was born in Newark, New Jersey. And I came from a very close Italian family, very strict Italian family, and a lot of love. So it would be very easy for me to sit here and say to you that what relates to me in this book and what I've learned from this book has to do with my being punished or abused or having something terrible happen in my life, and that's not really the case. I had a wonderful childhood, very happy kid, and my dad probably took two drinks in his entire life. I have an older sister and a younger brother, and neither one of them suffer from our disease. My mom was an alcoholic and a drug addict. She was addicted to painkillers, but she was a controlled drinker, and she always took care of us. She always took care of the home. It was very difficult. As a young child, I didn't know my mom had an issue, but she always had a drink in her hand. I learned a lot of this as I got older from my siblings and the rest of the family. So this part of my life of not having these consequences and having these terrible things that led me to a drink or would force me or make me feel I needed to change the way I felt, I didn't experience those. So I want to clear that up because I think for me it's important. For me it was very important to realize that I really had no other excuse for my drinking and I know this is AA, but my ingestion of dry goods. And I'll leave it at that. So this book came into my life shortly after March 13th, 2007 in a way that I'll never forget. But we'll get to that when we get to the doctor's opinion. So this book was presented to me when I was finally really ready to accept it. Because that thing of you don't know what you don't know, and I wasn't ready for a solution because I didn't think I had a problem, kept me away from this book. And I ran from it. And I ran from sponsorship. And I ran from all of you because I didn't want to be like you. So when I was finally ready, the book was introduced to me, and my book here is a fourth edition. And my sponsors, I had two sponsors. My first sponsor was a gentleman by the name of Sergio. He came from the 5:30 Florham Park meeting. That's where I got clean and sober. It was up there. I lived up in Morris County. I still live up in Morris County. And then I after a year and a half, almost 2 years, I gravitated down to Dawn Patrol because I had finally gotten a job back in my chosen profession of construction, and the office was in Union, New Jersey, so that was great. I could hit that meeting, get the full hour, and still be at my desk by 8 a.m., so that was wonderful. So if you want to open your book, and we can start from exactly the way that it was presented to me, because there are a lot of things in here in this book, and it was used as an educational tool for me. I was told to look at this book as if I was in high school or I was in college, and to use this as something that I could learn from. So when we open the cover, the first two pages are blank, except mine says $6 in the top right-hand corner. And then the next two pages on the right, it just says Alcoholics Anonymous, and it announces the title to the book. And I happen to have an autograph from Carl M., who was a circuit speaker. I enjoy him. I like his message. And he happened to be at an event, and I wanted to get his autograph as though he was a rock star. So if you go to the next page, the information in the book gives me some other sources of literature that I can read if I so choose. And the other books it refers me to are the 12 Steps and the 12 Traditions, Alcoholics Anonymous Came to Age as Bill Sees It, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. And it'll give you a little line underneath it as to a little bit of a little eyedropper full as to what it's about. And goes on the booklets, Living Sober, which was something that I really relied on heavily in my first year of recovery because it broke it down simple for me. I was pretty shot when I came in, and I needed to get my legs back underneath me, and Living Sober was quite simple and to the point. And then the last book is AA in Prison, Inmate to Inmate, former Grapevine articles. So on the next page is Alcoholics Anonymous, and it gives me the first promise is presented to me before I even get to the first chapter. And the promise is the story, this book is the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism, fourth edition. So the word recovered is introduced to me very early on, probably a lot earlier than I could handle, because I didn't have any faith in myself at that point. I didn't trust myself. So the word recovered to me was a past tense word, and I couldn't grasp it. And it took me a long time, you know, to get back to what the definition of recovered is, which is back on page 84. And we'll jump there just for a second, just so that I needed to understand what that meant. And I really couldn't handle that until six months or a year into my recovery. So on the bottom of page 84, it tells me, it's another promise in the book. And it says, and we have ceased fighting anything and anyone, even alcohol. For by this time, sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as if from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally. We will find that this has happened automatically. That's interesting, because that never happened for me. For a long time, we will see that our new attitude towards liquor has been given to us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we have been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. And there's some more lines, and it gets into the spirituality, which it took me a while to get my arms wrapped around that. I wasn't ready. So my teachers introduced me to some other books. So this is the Little Big Book Dictionary, because there are a lot of words in here. This book was written in 1939. I don't speak this way. I don't talk this way, especially when I got into Bill's story. Chapter 1, and they started using terms in there, and there's phrases in here, boiled as an owl and things like that. I didn't know what that was, but there were words, and this is a great book. You can get it online at Area 44. You can get it at any kind of if you go to any seminars, you go to any workshops, if you go to the convention, there's all books for sale. It'll just give you some additional insight as to help you with some of the words. So if we flip to the next page, It explains first edition copyrighted in 39, next 55, 76, and 2001. And then it goes on to state the printings. Next is a table of contents. And then it lists out the personal stories. And that goes on for two or three or four pages. So we get to the preface, and I have to be honest with you, when I do something like this in this setting, I'm not going to dig into that word by word, because a lot of people will fall asleep, and a lot of people are not going to be interested. I just want to point out a couple of things. One of the things that I want to point out to you is in the middle of the page, it talks about the doctor's opinion has been kept intact just as it was originally written in 1939 by the late Dr. William D. Silkworth, our society's great medical benefactor. We're going to get into the doctor's opinion this week, and that story holds a lot of meaning and impact on my early recovery. But it means a lot to me to look at that and realize that that story has not changed from 1939, and the medical field has not challenged that, because I have to be honest with you, I wake up one morning and butter is not good for me, the next day it's okay for me, eggs are not good, and so I think you understand what I'm saying. So it was important for me to know that as I read through this book, there was something in here that was never challenged or changed, and although it says the doctor's opinion, to know a little bit of a backstory about Dr. Silkworth, which we'll talk about a little bit, is something that is very meaningful to me. So, excuse me. Some of the other things and places that I go for information, my sponsor Carl is a big history nut and buff. So I get that knowledge from him. He has 33 years, and he loves AA history. So he will push me into readings, he will push me into places, and he'll say to me quite often, don't let me read your big book for you. Pick it up, read it. If you think what I'm telling you is not true or you think there's something false about it, read it and come back to me and let's talk about it. And he's always urged me to do that, which was great. He's not that kind of sponsor where it's my way or the highway. He's encouraging me constantly to seek. So there's a website, silkworth.net, and there is a tremendous amount of AA history on that website. If you get a chance, Google it up and read some of the stories. You can read about Dr. Silkworth and some of the characters that are in the book, Roland Hazard and some of the other people that we'll meet and talk about as the weeks go on. So the preface, again, it'll give you on the next page just some other information, and then we get to the foreword to the first edition, which was written in 1939. So the book presents the foreword just as it was written in 1939. If you're interested in how it was written and what was stated, please read it. I urge you to read it. The next page, when you flip it, is the foreword to the second edition. And that's some 16 years later. And they get into some numbers of how AA has grown. And they talk about 150,000 recovered alcoholics. So you know what, by now, you've already learned what the word recovered means. So you know they're referring to some people that have been placed in a position of neutrality, right, and so on and so forth. So a foreword to the second edition goes on for a couple of pages, and I think if you read it, you'll figure it out and you look at it yourself. It's talking about the growth, and it's talking about the groups that are starting to pop up. It references Bill Dotson in here, which is AA number 3. That's the man on the bed, if you've ever seen the picture with Bill and Dr. Bob standing by the bed with the man in the bed. That's Bill Dotson. And it'll go on and describe, it talks a little bit about 1940 with John D. Rockefeller and how Bill was excited and hoped that we were going to get a lot of money, and the Jack Alexander Saturday Evening Post, that's something great for you to Google and read of how AA was looked at back then. And then we come into the forward to the third edition, which is some 37 years later. That's one page. And then the forward to the fourth edition, which was 62 years later, and that's where we are now. So if you turn the page, we come into this chapter that I'm talking about. And it's not even chapter one, but there's the doctor's opinion. So the way the doctor's opinion plays out in my life is that I'm not a first-time winner. My last year and a half of my drinking career, I was in two detoxes, two rehabs, and numerous emergency rooms, hospital visits. I couldn't stop drinking. I could not stop. And by the time March 13th, 2007 rolled around, I was pretty well beat up. I was at a point emotionally bankrupt. And my mindset was simply that, and I'm not going to be dramatic because I never attempted it, I wanted to die. I did not have the guts or the fortitude to carry that through. But I did not know what to do. I was in a terrible place. So this is a AA meeting book. I'm sure most of you have seen it before. So there was a meeting, and they came in one time, and they read the inside. If you read the inside of this, there's some first, there's the steps. There's a little bit from how it works. There's what is AA, preamble, tradition, serenity, prayer. But these gentlemen had come into a detox that I happened to be visiting, and they read this paragraph, and there was this beginning of, for me, was this attachment, was me being able to feel that there was someone out there that was speaking to me that got it, that was suffering from the same thing I was suffering from. I was living on page 52, and that's on We Agnostic. Those are the bedevilments, and if you're not sure what they are, we'll go to the book. We'll go to the dictionary. How's that? And I'll tell you what it is so that you know. And it's not my opinion. This is what it says. It says the bedevilments, troubles, torments, disturbances, aggravations, and it refers back to page 52. That's where I was at. But these guys came in, and I didn't read the bedevilments at that point, so I didn't know what it was. But this is what they read to me. They read a part of the chapter of Vision for You, which is in the back towards the end of the first 164 pages. And it talks about, and it says, this is what they said to me, and they spoke to me. They said, the unhappiest person in the world is the alcoholic who has an insistent yearning to enjoy life as he once knew it, but cannot picture life without alcohol. He has a heartbreaking obsession that by some miracle of control, he will be able to do so. Someday, he will be unable to imagine life either with alcohol or without it. Then he will know loneliness, such as few do. He will be at the jumping-off place. He will wish for the end. AA can and does show these people a solution to their problem, and its greatest recommendation is it works. I heard these two gentlemen read this, and they had my attention. They had my attention. Little did I know one of those men would turn out to be my first sponsor, and how God put him in my life after I went through detox. I went through rehab, and I came back up to North Jersey. I did my last rehab down in South Jersey, and I walked into my first AA meeting. It was a 10:30 Saturday morning meeting, and I was scared, man. I was frightened because I had no more adult supervision. I was on my own. I'm making my own decisions, and The good news for me is I did what I was told to do when I went to an AA meeting as soon as we drove up from South Jersey. And across the room, I heard someone say to someone else, "Hey, good morning, Sergio." And that's not really a common word in my life. I'm Italian, but I don't have a lot of Sergios. We have a lot of Anthony's and Peter's and Maria's, but we don't have a lot of Sergios. So I looked across the room and I heard him speak, and Sergio, anyone who knows him, has this deep, bellowing kind of a voice. He should be a radio DJ on like WNEW or the old rock stations, but he's got that deep voice. And he spoke, and I said, "Man, that sounds like him." But it took me almost two or three more weeks to ask him to be my sponsor. You would think I was asking somebody on a date, but that's another story. So, and his answer to me was, here's my card, kid. Call me. If I answer, I answer. If I don't, I'll call you back." And he walked away from me, and I was kind of like, "That's it? Don't you know who I am? You're not excited to be my sponsor." So anyway, so I'm giving you a little bit of a background before I got off on that meeting with Sergio about my emotional state and my hopelessness. And I was also physically beat up because I had 3 days before that I had passed out in my home. I pretty much I'd locked myself in the house and was just drinking and taking my dry goods 24/7, and my brother broke into the house because I wasn't answering my phone and I wasn't showing up for anything. I had my own businesses at that time and I couldn't make my own business meetings. And he broke in and he found me upstairs in the kitchen, and I was passed out. I had hit my head on the side of a low partition that was in my kitchen, had a little marble top on it. I had passed out because I was mixing alcohol and Xanax at that time, and I learned very quickly one of the side effects is you fall down a lot. And I fell down a lot. And so Raymond was my brother's Raymond, and I started to come to, and he was sitting in front of me right about the same distance that my friend Michael is sitting. And I was on the floor, and I got on my knees, I pulled myself up, and I had this feeling of being empty, and I had this feeling of I was cold. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know if I should sit down, stand up. I was weak. I didn't think I could move at all. I was confused, and Raymond was on his cell phone. He was calling 911, and I looked at him. And I said the three words that I had said so many times before that I never meant. I just would say them to get people out of my face. And I looked at him and I said, "I need help." And I meant it. I meant it that time. So this is my frame of mind. This is my physical appearance. And I'm in Summit Oaks. And I'm about a day and a half in there, so they've got me pumped up on vitamins, anti-seizure medications, and all this. So what happens is, and it talks about in the book, we'll read it, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. And my mind is now deciding it's going to start taking over a little bit. And I'm going to start telling people in workshop that the fourth step is not written right, and that this book is really nonsense, and I don't want to go to all of my group sessions to smoke. They're my cigarettes. Why do I have to stand in line to get a cigarette? And oh, by the way, when am I getting coffee with caffeine in it? I've had enough of this. So my doctor was Dr. Berman, and he said, "Tom, go to your room," he said, "and read the doctor's opinion." And my first thought was much like when I was a kid and my mom sent me to my room for not eating my vegetables. Yes, I'm out of here. I don't have to do this. So I shuffled down the hallway with my slippers and my wristband on and my sweatpants, and I'm back in my room, and I open up my bid book, And I read the first paragraph, and the first paragraph just simply says, "We of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book. Convincing testimony must surely come from medical men who have had experience with the sufferings of our members and have witnessed our return to health. A well-known doctor, chief physician at a nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcohol and drug addiction, gave Alcoholics Anonymous this letter." Okay? Do you remember that, what we just read, that paragraph? I couldn't remember that. I could not remember that. So I read it again. And I read it word for word, and I could not remember what that said by the time I got to the end of the first paragraph. So I read it two more times, and then what began to come over me was this gift, what I call a gift of hopelessness and fear. As I told you, I'm this kid that grew up in Newark, and we grew up in a time in Newark where we had a lot of freedom, and there was a lot of stuff going on in Newark, and there was a lot of things, not all bad, it was just, you could go out and on your bike, you could ride a bike by yourself. You could go out and play with your friends, and my signal to be home was when the street lights came on, I better be home. And so for me, my attitude was, if you punch me in the nose, is that the best you got? You got anything better than that? No big deal, laugh in your face. But the only thing that I feared was fear. And that's the only thing that got my attention, was when I was afraid of something. And I began to be afraid at that point, laying on my bed in Summit, New Jersey, and I'm saying, uh-oh, I think I've done it this time. And my recovery rate before that was 2 or 3 days, maybe 4 days tops, and I'm back on my feet, and I'm ready to rip and run again, and I'll wait till Friday, but maybe Thursday night festivities, we're going to go. And so I was able to always bounce back. I felt this time I was screwed, and I had done some damage. So what does that mean, and how does this relate to my experience? It just simply means that the nurses, the aides, the counselors, all of a sudden had this little bit of a higher being or meaning in my life. I was still a wise guy. I was still a smart ass. Can I say ass? I think I just said it twice. But I still had this ego, and I had this pride, and I had this voice inside my head that was screaming at me, you're not an alcoholic. You're not an alcoholic. And that's the voice that would scream to me. It sounds just like me. I believe that it's me, and it's screaming, man. You're not an alcoholic, and I fought it. And this chapter, there's so much in here. When I was finally able, and I couldn't grasp this until I got out of rehab and back up and started working with Sergio, and we read this chapter. But there are so many things in here, and And after that first paragraph that I read, there's this letter and from William D. Silkworth, and I urge you to read it. I want to give you a little bit of homework and some things to do, but I really urge you to read it. In here, in this book, in this paragraph, right from the beginning, they start talking about spirituality. So, if we go to page 28, Roman numeral 28, on the bottom of that page, there was something there that grabbed me, and it starts off by saying that I have the fourth edition. So, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Everybody got that? You there? Okay. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, you know what injurious is, right? Consequences, it may not be a punch in the nose, but there could be a court date, there could be something, loss of license. While they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems like the only normal one. So that right there is something that followed me through. Carl, my current sponsor, reminds me that I'm delusional. And that just simply means that I don't, at times, don't have a real good grasp of reality. And I need to understand that. I need to slow down. And it's not just in my recovery. It's in my personal life. It's in my family life. It's in my business life. And so in here, what he's saying is the alcoholic's life seems like the only normal one. So that means also to me that the pain that I know that I'm in right now is my pain. I know it because I am afraid to change. And I do not want to take any steps to change because I don't know what's there. I know my pain. It's much like the men that would come and bang on my front door to come and get me, to take me to a meeting, to take me to a detox. And I'm a grown man. I was 53 years old when I came into these rooms. And I'm a grown man, and I'm standing behind the door hiding. I'm peeking through the curtains, not because they're going to hurt me, it's because they're going to stop me from drinking. And they're probably going to take my Xanax and my coke away, and I don't want to give that up. I'm in pain, I'm suffering, I can't stop, but I'm not going to give it up. So it goes on to say they are restless, irritable, and discontented. Anybody can identify with that? That was my life. Unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks which they see others taking with impunity. So what that means to me is I have an older sister, I have a younger brother. My sister can have a glass of wine, go to sleep, get up and go to work. My brother can have a beer and not finish his beer and let it sit on the picnic table and get warm and flat and not really care much about it. And they have the same blood running through their veins that I have. We came from the same parents. What's wrong with me? Why can't I stop drinking? Why can't I stay stopped? Because I could stop, I just couldn't stay stopped. And I couldn't figure out what the heck was wrong with me. It goes on to say, after they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, the phenomenon of craving develops. They pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. I giggle because I don't know how many times I've said to my ex-wife, to my business partners, to whoever, no, I'm done. I've had enough. I'm not going to drink anymore. And either a few hours or a couple of days later, I'm finding a good excuse to have a drink. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope for his recovery. Hold on, Sergio, wait a minute. What is this psychic change that's referenced here? So he just simply says to me, it's a spiritual awakening, keep reading. And it's like, whoa, wait a minute. What's a spiritual awakening? Because I didn't come in to these rooms to find spirituality. I didn't come into these rooms to find anything other than a solution to my drinking. I can't stop. So he said to me, all right, here's the best thing that I can do. I'm going to take you back to page 567. We can go back to page 567 and in the fourth edition. And he said, this is the best way that I can explain this to you. And so this is Appendix 2, and it's referenced in two other chapters in this book. And Bill in the first 100 thought that this is so important that they referenced it twice in two different places in this book. He just took me there a little bit sooner because I started asking questions. So the spiritual experience describes the terms spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which upon careful reading shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. Yet it is true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that these personality changes or religious experiences, religious experiences. Why is that in there? Why are you making me read that? He said, just keep reading, relax. Don't dig too far into it. Religious experiences must be in the nature of sudden and spectacular upheavals. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. So, I know we jumped ahead. I want you to know what my experience was, and my experience was he took me here. When we get to Bill's story, which is the next chapter, actually chapter one, Bill, at a point in there, in the Bill's solution, he'll talk about what is referred to as a white light experience. And I heard that when I came in. Bill talked about, felt like the wind was blowing through his hair, and there was this bright light in the room, and he was changed. I didn't experience that. I didn't. So the good thing for me is if we keep reading, it gives me the opportunity to understand that there is hope for me. So it says that, yes, it is true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that these personality changes or religious experience must be in the nature of sudden. We read that. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. Because remember, we're on step one right now. You know, although we're back here, we're still talking about step one, powerless, life unmanageable. Although it was not our intention to create such an impression, many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, there's that word again, they must acquire an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness. Oh man, God, here we go. Now, we just started, Sergio. What do you... God. Relax, Tom. Keep reading. Followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. So, basically what's being suggested is this: my perception of reality. Always talk about glass half full. Stop living in the darkness. Stop gloom and doom. Glass half full. So it talks about a vast change in feeling and outlook. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Here's my get out of jail card, because it's telling me I don't have to have a white light experience. Most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety. I raise my hand because that was my experience with this book. I had to learn this. I had to learn what was happening around me. I wasn't getting that glow, that wind in my hair, although I had none, and that feeling of power. I hadn't gotten it yet, and I said it before, and I'll say it again. It took me a long time to realize or feel comfortable that I could do this. So. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find that they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. We'll hear that when Ebby talks to Bill and he sits at his kitchen table in Bill's story and he suggests to him, make your own conception of your higher power. Most of us think that this awareness of a power greater than ourselves is the essence of spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. Most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover. There's the word again. Provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, squiggly lines. So when you see the squiggly lines, it's important. It costs more money for them to write in squiggly lines, just so you know that when they published it. So it meant it was important. Squiggly lines. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery. But these are indispensable. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. Herbert Spencer. So, if you heard me, I kept saying to you, well, you're talking to me about spirituality, you're talking to me about God, you're talking to me about this word religion, and my mind was snapping shut. And all Sergio was suggesting to me was to take a deep breath, relax, and keep reading. So the part at the end that we read, contempt prior to investigation, I needed to understand what that meant, because although I suffered from that, stubborn, close-minded, that contempt prior to investigation, I talked to you about my mom with the vegetables. So my mom would say, we're having Brussels sprouts tonight. I don't like Brussels sprouts. Well, you've never had Brussels sprouts. I don't like them. Well, how do you know you don't like them? Because I don't like them. That's contempt prior to investigation. I love Brussels sprouts tonight. So that was, this is this education thing that I needed to go through. I needed to understand who I was and what was going on. So going back to we're now on page 29 in the doctor's opinion. It'll go out through that page, and it says, men have cried out to me in sincere disparaging appeal. Doctor, I cannot go on like this. I have everything to live for. I must stop, but I cannot. You must help me. So flip the page, right? We're going to fast forward, and we're going to go to 31. So what's there? Good news. On the top of the page, it says, what is the solution? It's a question. It's asking a question. What is the solution? And the nice thing about this book is that it gives me the answer. And it's going to give me something that maybe, if I'm buying into any of this, is going to give me something that will help me in my recovery. So it says, what is the solution? Mm-hmm. Perhaps I can best answer this by relating one of my experiences. So this, as I read this, there are going to be certain words in here that talk about where I was at as I described to you, and where I was at that point, and and what this chapter means. About 1 year prior to this experience, a man was brought in to be treated for chronic alcoholism. He had but partially recovered from a gastric hemorrhage and seemed to be a case of pathological mental deterioration. Wow. He had lost everything worthwhile in his life and was only living, one might say, to drink. He frankly admitted and believed that for him there was no hope. Here's the beginning of the solution. Part of the solution is the feeling of hopelessness. I don't know how it is for you, and I don't know if you work with any other men and taking them through the book, but I can say for me, if I felt that I had one more run in me, if I felt that there was something that I did not try yet, whether it be just drinking beer, whether it just be drinking brown colored liquor, whether it be just drinking in a bar and not at home, if I felt there was something else that I hadn't tried yet and there was something else and I was still going to experiment, I wasn't hopeless. It was only a matter of time I was going back out again. And it was only until I began to feel those feelings of hopelessness was my mind able to open up. I like to refer to it now as being cracked open. Mm-hmm. And now it's like, okay, we talk about being a sponge, be teachable. And that's when that began. I didn't know what was happening. I'm going to tell you right now, I'll be honest with you. I didn't know that's what was happening to me, but that's what was happening. So for him, there was no hope. Following the elimination of alcohol, okay, total abstinence, There was found to be no permanent brain injury. He accepted the plan as outlined in this book. 1 year later, he called to see me. I experienced a very strange sensation. I knew the man by name and partly recognized his features, but there all resemblance ended. From a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck had emerged a man brimming over with self-reliance and contentment. I talked with him for some time, but was not able to bring myself to feel that I had known him before. To me, he was a stranger, and so he left me. A long time has passed, and no return to alcohol. When I need a mental uplift, I often think of another case brought in by a physician prominent in New York. The patient had made his own diagnosis and, deciding his situation hopeless, there's the word, had hidden in a deserted barn, determined to die. He was rescued by a searching party and in desperate condition brought to me. Following his physical rehabilitation, he had a talk with me in which he frankly stated he thought the treatment a waste of time. Unless I could assure him, which no one ever had, that in the future he would have the willpower or control to resist the impulse to drink. His alcohol problem was so complex, his depression so great, that we felt the only hope would be through what we then called moral psychology, and we doubted if even that would have any effect. However, he did become sold. Again, it's pushing me back into this book. It's pushing me back into the steps. It's saying the solution. However, he did become sold on the ideas contained in this book. He had not had a drink for a great many years. I see him now and then, and he is a fine specimen of manhood, as one could wish to meet. I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book through and through. Perhaps he came to scoff. He may remain to pray. William D. Silkworth, M.D. So I want to just point out one other thing in this chapter, if I can find it. And it says, it talks about, and the men of these type cannot ingest alcohol in any form. And I apologize. And anybody that can find that for me, I'll give you an attaboy or an attagirl or an attaperson. It's in this chapter. But anyway, so what does that mean? And this is 1939, so it's saying to me alcohol in any form, that means liquid or solid. It references in this chapter total abstinence. And that's where this begins, the hopelessness, followed by the total abstinence, followed by the ideas, following the ideas and the concepts as they're outlined in this book. What is that? That's the first 164 pages. And already in this, we're not even on chapter one, and there's been a lot of information given to us. What I just mentioned, and they even stuck a little spirituality in there. They even stuck a little reference to God, which for me, obviously, is what the program in many ways is about for me. But they've given us so much already, and now we're on chapter one, which is Bill's story. So I'd like to start it, if that's all right. Can we do that? And Michael can finish it.
Yeah.
Next week, if that's all right.
Yeah.
Okay.
That would be great.
So, all right. So this chapter was one that was very confusing for me because I don't talk this way, and I don't reference things this way. So this is kind of like the army. You leave the room and you get volunteers for stuff.
Boy.
So you're going to finish Bill's story next week. So I have, and I know you're all going to be disappointed. I have a family obligation in Portland, Maine next weekend. So Michael has humbly agreed to jump in for me and pick up for 1 week, and then I'll be back. So I apologize for doing that. But I didn't realize when Denise had asked me and I agreed that I have all these dead brain cells, and I just didn't connect the dots on that weekend. So I appreciate your patience with me. So Bill Story, Chapter 1, and Bill Story is 16 pages. It was explained to me before I read it that it's broken up, and I was asked to look for it. So the first 8 pages are the problem, going all the way down to where it says near the end of the bleak November, I sat drinking on page 8. That's the problem. The next 8 pages are Bill's solution. So before we get into this a little bit, I want to just say this to you, because I didn't want to. I read 2 pages and I put it down and I said, that's it, I don't want to bother. This is ridiculous. Hampshire Grenadier and drinks, whether they dieth by musket or by pot, you know. And so this is what it was said. Do me a favor, relax, Tom. Sergio said a lot, relax. And he said to me, see if you can identify with what Bill's talking about. See if you can identify with his feelings. See if you can think like Bill thought. If you drank the way Bill drank, meaning not the same type liquor, but with the same vengeance and no matter what, and then am I willing to do what Bill did to recover? And when I was asked to look at it that way, this whole chapter took on a new meaning for me. And we went out and we started reading it. So again, we're good. Can I get into it, or is this too late?
No, it's fine. I was just looking something up.
All right. No, I'm not sure, so I wanted to make sure.
Yeah, no.
All right. So the beginning of this. So this is Bill W's story, right? Most of you people know that. If you didn't, then this is what it is, and it tells his story, and it tells how he recovered. So in the beginning, it says war fever ran high in the New England town to which we new young officers from Plattsburgh were assigned. We were flattered when the first citizen took us into their homes, making us feel heroic. Here was love, applause, war, moments sublime with intervals hilarious. I was part of life at last, and in the midst of the excitement, I discovered liquor. So he's a very young man, and he's up in there, and this is, at this point, this is still a glorious time for him. I mean, he's going off to war, but this is a glorious time for him, and people are very supportive. So I discovered liquor. I forgot the strong warnings and the prejudices of my people concerning drink. In time, we sailed for over there. I was very lonely and again turned to alcohol. We landed in London. I visited Winchester Cathedral, much moved. I wandered outside. My attention was caught by a doggerel on an old tombstone. Here lies a Hampshire grenadier who caught his death by drinking cold beer. A good soldier is ne'er forgot, whether he dieth by musket or by pot. So there's a couple of words in here, and one of them is doggerel, because I don't know what that means. So in my little big book dictionary, it says poorly or irregularly written and often humorous verse. So that makes a little more sense for me to understand what's there. And I didn't know what a Hampshire grenadier was. So bear with me and let me tell you about a Hampshire grenadier. Does anybody know?
No, I can look it up for you.
Okay. So
it's not in here.
You're getting there faster?
Yeah,
grenadier?
It's not in here.
Oh, it's not in there. So anyway, so this was a soldier. This was a soldier back in the day, back in that time. That was a very prestigious soldier. They were an elite group of that branch of the armed forces.
Grenadier is a member of the British Army who carries grenades or a grenade thrower.
Right. So they were very specialized, and they died anyway because they have this disease, and that didn't protect them. So what it says, though, ominous warning, which I failed to heed. And so did I. 22 and a veteran of foreign wars, I went home at last. I fancied myself a leader, for had not the men of the battery given me a special token of appreciation. So full of himself, much like I am, pride, ego. They gave me this award. I must be something special. My talent for leadership, I imagine, would place me at the head of vast enterprises, which I would manage with the utmost assurance. Okay, Bill. No problem. I took a night law course. Now, let's see if he finishes any of this stuff. I took a night law course and obtained employment as an investigator for a surety company. The drive for success was on. I proved to the world I was important. My work took me about Wall Street, and little by little, I became interested in the market. Many people lost money, but some became very rich. Why not I? I studied economics and business as well as law. Potential alcoholic that I was, I nearly failed my law course. At one of the finals, I was too drunk to think or write. Though my drinking was not yet continuous, it disturbed my wife. We had long talks when I would still her forebodings by telling her that men of genius conceive their best projects when drunk, that the most majestic constructions of philosophic thought were so derived. So I don't know if you can identify with what Bill's expressing there and what he's feeling, and this whole being strapped to the back of a rocket ship, and he's got everything in front of him, and he's looking at himself where he's got his whole life and all is in front of him, and he's got some confidence and he's got some bunch of pride and ego, and he's going and he's ready to go. But he references in there how alcohol is playing and liquor is playing a big part in his life. So much of a part that he was too drunk to take one of his exams. I don't know if you can identify with that, but I, not in regards to taking exams, but in life and showing up. So I think we're going to stop there.
Yeah, we stop.
Okay, we'll stop there. And then you'll take it. Sure. From there next week. So I thank you very much, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here.